This is Air Commander Starscream, and you are listening to Half Measures. Half Measures? Sounds like Megatron's battle strategy.
Kia ora and welcome to episode 209 of the Half Measures podcast. I'm once again joined by my friend and co-host, Mr. Borkenauer. How are you tonight, Paul?
Kia ora, Dan. I'm really good. Yourself?
I'm not too bad. I have been living with a little bit of regret since our last podcast. You know, I feel
all over
like,
your face.
Could it have been worse timing for me to sort of make reference to Kate Middleton and the conspiracies going on, and then I don't know what's going on with the Palace social media manager and our social media manager, but it would have been pretty good to get a heads up that she was going to drop a big cancer diagnosis announcement so that I didn't, you know, make a fool of myself. But here we are. So and I've been thinking, what did I say? Was it that bad? Like, I hope it wasn't. And then I'm like, I could check, but it's not the Half Measures way.
No. And I think probably what was, I don't know, not worse was like how, because of course we record, you know, a couple of days before. So it's almost like the podcast came out when the, and no one would intend that, of course. And of course there was so much speculation and so much, but it's turned out to be something very, very unfortunate, very, very sad. And I think everyone who listens to this podcast knows you well enough now, Dan.
It's like in the early days of COVID when I was like, look, if you've got COVID, you know, listen to the pod. And then like, it was like at the start of COVID and it was like, it just got worse and worse and worse. It's like, I think say nothing is the key. So don't comment on social things.
Yeah, don't go back to our early podcasts and listen to some of the comments that were made when COVID first came out and we were all sure, is this really a thing? Is it just a load of media rubbish? Turns out it was a thing.
It's like an episode of The Morning Show when they're discovering COVID. So anyway, Paul, I digress. We wish Kate Middleton all the best and hopefully speedy recovery. But back to business, Paul. What have you been watching this week?
Okie doke. Well, before I talk specifically about the TV show I want to bring, if you want to indulge me for 90 seconds, because I just, you know, this is about what you've been watching. Something I watched this week was Question Time.
I was going to say, it's going to be something about parliamentary TV.
it's Question Time at Parliament, but it's not on Parliament TV, but live in person in the house, in the viewing gallery. I was like, I watch this a lot on TV, and obviously that's why I keep talking about, oh, this is what have you been watching? Sooner or later, it's all going to be about it. But honestly, I'll be very brief. Being there in person was a truly extraordinary experience. The heckling, and I think this would be the true if you were to look at the UK House of Commons or Australia or any sort of Senate type setting. What you hear on TV with the mic, just like you can hear, you know, with my mic, sort of drowns out the background. But when you're there live in person, I felt like I was in a school classroom. That's what it felt like. It was just unreal how loud the heckling was. And as someone who was there in person, you can hear specific heckles and what people are saying. And it's well, maybe I'm a geek, but it was pure entertainment for me.
Were you doing any of the heckling, Paul, or were you being one of the well-behaved students?
No, I was well briefed by Madam Speaker, shall we say, who said there is to be absolute silence from you the entire time. Kanawa, also help me, we'll never come here again. So I mean I was very much at the sort of like on the verge of clapping at certain things, but what I found most, just to wrap it up, what I found most interesting was just being able to watch the face of any MP or any minister you choose to, because what you see on TV is what the camera shows you, and it's typically between the MP who asks the question and the minister who responds or the speaker. But sat in the gallery, I was sat above the opposition, so I was directly opposite the Prime Minister, Deputy Prime Minister, and all the other wonderful ministers from this coalition government, and just being able to see their faces or watch someone else's face as the Prime Minister is answering a question and they're just like looking at each other going, sort of shrugging, and like it's pure entertainment. And honestly, if you're ever in Wellington, or it's free, there was heaps of free seats, you just go on in. And when you go in, by the way, when you go in through the doors of the Beehive, we arrive quite late perhaps, but all the cameras, all the media are there facing you as you walk through those doors. All the cameras pointing right at you with the microphones and all the reporters who, of course, you recognise from the TV because they're waiting for the ministers who, when we turned around, funnily enough, were just behind us. And it's the exposure you get in New Zealand, because I don't think you would get that level of closeness, you know, in other countries, certainly not like in the US. Could you imagine being that close? It just wouldn't happen. But they're literally just walking past us and various party leaders were passing us on the stairs. Look, I won't lie to you, Dan. It was, in terms of what I've watched this week, it was an absolute highlight. It was real entertainment.
I really hope you're wearing your half measures t-shirt as you walked in front of those cameras. That's the type of advertising we need. But I don't know if it's quite hitting the demographic and the audience we're looking for, but still any advertising is good advertising.
Yeah. I didn't think about what I wore that morning as I went into the city. I was wearing a blue top, and on reflection, I wondered, should I have worn a different colour? But, you know, let's not go there.
More neutral.
Stay neutral. Wow. But that was one of the things I'd be watching. I did say I'd be brief, and there I go. Once again, talking and talking. You should see me in my day job. This week, Dan, I have brought to the table the fifth season of the Australian TV series Utopia. This is a series that you and I have spoken about in the past, and I know you watched the first couple of seasons as well. And in fact, it was you who actually said to me, Paul, you should check this out. Well, I certainly did, and I've carried on with it. And following on from the season 3 and 4 reviews, just to bring anyone up to speed who hasn't heard me talk about this before, this is a comedy set inside the offices of the Nation Building Authority, the NBA, a newly created government organization responsible for overseeing major infrastructure projects. This fifth season actually dropped in Australia late last year, but we only just recently got it here in New Zealand, and I cannot tell you, Dan, how much it annoys me because we've had to wait that long, and of course we've already recorded our top 10 TV shows for 2023, but if this had dropped in New Zealand in 2023, I'd have watched it straight away, and this would have, without a doubt, made my list. This is my favourite Australian TV series of all time. I absolutely love it.
I think why did I stop watching this? I actually think it's probably because I watched it alone with our Patreon producer, Samara Whiting King, and I wonder whether I actually need to sort of go back and re-induct her into this series so that we can sort of carry, because it would be the perfect kind of filler TV show, and it's so good. And there's no reason why I stopped watching. I think just other things came up, but it's awesome to hear that season 5 is just as good. And even looking at these IMDb reviews, like many like 8s, high 8s, almost 9s for some of these reviews. So great stuff.
It really is. Every episode has genuine gems, genuine laugh out loud moments. And I would say, Dan, for anyone who's listening who's ever worked in an office environment, this show has things in it that you will relate to. If you've ever worked in the public service, this will 100% be something you'll be able to relate to. And then if you've worked for a ministry or Crown agency, well, this is basically your everyday life. And so if you think about, you know, obviously The Office or Parks and Recreation, for me, this is right up there with those sort of shows. And everyone in this show collectively, all the way through to the minister, who they also make out to be an absolute clown. These people, with the exception of two cast members or two characters, I should say, have no clue what they're doing. And it's just so funny to watch them struggle through everyday life in government.
It's always so fascinating with a show like this. And I think this is weird for me, like, obviously being Australian, like it hits a little bit closer to home, whereas, you know, like Parks and Rec and The Office, maybe not so much the UK Office feels like quite real, but I feel like particularly the American versions, like though fantastic, have a element of surrealism about it. But I think this feels real life, and it fascinates me about maybe what it's like in the writer's room and how much experience you have to actually have living and breathing this world to actually write pure comedic gold and turn it into something like, because it's so just everyday things. I've got so many like great memories of this show just with like, you know, branding changes or security card access or trying to get briefings done, trying to justify where money comes from. It's such a laugh a minute show. I think when I think of great comedies, this is definitely well up there.
It truly is, and it's it just never gets old as well. And there's something in every episode, as I say, that just always makes you laugh. The basic premise, you know, without, this isn't really spoilers. This, you know, this isn't a drama. There's no spoilers here. They just want to build for the sake of building, no matter the cost or the feasibility. And they just don't care. They're just like, oh, we should always be building. And one of the things I find, just to take it back to politics briefly, is hilarious how they constantly bemoan like the Green Party or the Greenies who want to protect the land. And the way they talk about them is, you know, within the confines of the show is hilarious, like how they're always trying to block us, those Greenies. Tony and Nat. So those are the two characters who are essentially the only two normal people connected to reality in the show. They're the person who I think I am in my office, right? They're the people who anyone listening to this podcast who works in office thinks that they are, because it's always the other people in those other departments. They're the weird ones, right? They're the ones who team up with you on projects and just who form the basis of like 1,000 Instagram reels and TikToks about what it's like to be in corporate office life. Tony and Nat are the sanity. And for anyone who doesn't work in government, they're the people you hope everyone is like in reality, because, you know, they're spending your hard-earned tax money. But no, there's unfortunately many people who are like this in real life, and that's what makes it funny.
I think it's, you kind of need the people that are grounded in reality to make these shows work. Like, you need, if everyone's a clown, like the humor's kind of lost. But I think it's
correct.
It's showing like Scott's frustration of just trying to navigate like simple bureaucratic processes that just makes it so good. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
This has made me want to rewatch. I need to go back to the beginning, like not for any real reason, but to, you know, to make it a family commitment.
Yeah, and it's so easy, and the episodes are so quick, it would be a real easy watch. Honestly, give it a go would be my advice to people. I do want to, if I may, just quickly talk about three characters who just top tier. I mean, everyone's great, top tier. The first character is Jim. Jim, who's played by Anthony Lehman, he's the government liaison communications press release person. He has no idea what's really happening or what it might mean for the public or the taxpayer. He doesn't care. He just wants buzzwords. He wants hype for the media, and he wants great news stories for the minister to take to cabinet. Absolutely superb. Kitty Flanagan, who plays Rhonda, quintessentially reminds me of someone who you and I have both worked with to the point where I feel they must have done a study on her and based the character around her entirely. Down to mannerisms, completely out of touch reality, goes off on tangents, knee-jerk reactions, demanding expectations, no concept of time or resource planning, just the worst possible type of person to have to deliver projects to. just a delightful character. And finally, Emma Louise Wilson, who plays Katie. Every office needs a Katie, as she provides that humor that is unintended, which I think is the best humor of all. Watching her constantly walk into Tony's office and just being on such a different planet, such a different wavelength to what Tony, as CEO, is thinking. You know, Tony's there shrugging and looking bemused by what she has to say, and she just carries on in her own world. And it's just absolutely brilliant. Emma Louise Wilson's delivery and timing of delivery and face expressions are up there for me with I don't know what the actress's name is, sorry, the one from Alexis from Schitt's Creek, just in terms of that sort of level of delivery is just so good. That's the level we're talking for me. And as I say, I can only hope that there's more seasons to come, because they have quite a few years between seasons, and I'm not sure what the deal is there, and I have no idea if there's a sixth season coming, but I will be there for it.
I've made a real rookie's error looking at this IMDb page, because I can kind of see some of the characters like Luke actually aren't in it for all the seasons. And yeah, it's kind of like, bummer.
Yeah. Another one. Yeah. So the character of Hugh was a favorite from those first couple of seasons, but they bring in new characters and there's no one who disappoints. That's the greatest thing. Cause you know, you think about the Office, the US Office, and the transition of characters they had there. Mm. They always level up, and it stays at the same level. So yeah, you know, as I say, if you like The Office, if you like Parks and Recreation, and if you love that Australian humor as well, this is definitely a show I would recommend, and that is on Netflix.
Awesome. Have they still got all seasons? I presume they probably do.
Nice. They do.
Okay, awesome. Oh, well, that's a good one to bring to the pod.
So yeah, just that and my trip to Parliament for me this week, Dan. What have you been watching, sir?
All right. So, because the other thing, we've got a couple of joint reviews for you this week. We've got a movie and our watch of the week, but in build up to our movie, our joint movie we've watched, I have been trying to get up to date on all of the Mission Impossible movies. So last week I talked about Mission Impossible 3. This week I have got Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, Mission Impossible Fallout, and then the joint watch of Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. But before we jump into Dead Reckoning Part 1, I thought let's just talk through these other three movies a little bit. Now, full warning, they've all kind of blurred together into my head into one giant Tom Cruise cocktail of espionage, over-the-top stunts, and pretty much non-stop action for most of the time. So I'm going to probably struggle to differentiate between like where some of the core things happen, but maybe we'll just sort of run through them just quickly as a bit of a reminder for people. And I've got to be upfront here in saying that I think watching them, like refreshing myself, like some of them I haven't seen. So I think I'd only seen up to Mission Impossible 3. I might have seen a few little bits of Protocol, but I definitely hadn't seen the others. So it definitely made a lot more sense watching this as a continuous story. And I felt much more kind of connected to IMF and some of the characters that they either carry on with or sort of reintroduce. And it was quite a surprise. I don't know why it was a surprise, but it was that Jeremy Renner makes an appearance in Ghost Protocol. And it's like, it's kind of great. Like, you can kind of, it feels, you know, when he kind of got, you know, involved in obviously like the Avengers, and when he sort of had a bit of a spin-off in the Bourne Identity movies, like he's such a great action star, and it was great to have him sort of alongside Tom Cruise. Obviously some great, with all of these movies, some real great set pieces, but being in Dubai, giant sandstorms, scaling the Burj Khalifa tower, you know, as you sort of referenced last week, some great spy scenes with some great like spy tech. And I think that's always my favorite thing in all of these Mission Impossible movies. It's a little bit like James Bond. Like, I love the kind of the gadgets. And I think, you know, Ghost Protocol is great. I kind of like that they've kind of gone rogue. They've had to go off the books. They're trying to sort of reclaim their sort of identity and who they are. So I thoroughly enjoyed Ghost Protocol.
Yeah, Ghost Protocol is a strong entry for me in terms of the whole series. It does have that scene that I tried desperately not to spoil for you last week. Sorry. It has that great start. It's got a really strong start. And then I always remember the opening credit scene, because as you're sort of following the scene, Ethan Hunt's walking down the tunnel and he just turns to the camera and he's like, light the fuse. And then the music kicks in. And that for me is classic Mission Impossible. And it's up there with those classic cinematic moments from any movie that you think is classic. It's right up there. It really is that moment. It's a little on the nose for some people, but I just think it really works well. The introductions of Jeremy Renner, Paula Patton, Lea Seydoux all come in. They're great. The stunts, you can feel the intensity is ramping up. And I think as you talk through the movies, it sort of goes up. But yeah, it's a really, really strong entry into it. I think the Burj Khalifa is kind of almost like, we talk about set plays in movies, and I think they maybe sort of lent into that a little too much and made it such a big thing, such a big build up, but it works. I mean, at the end of the day, the stunts are incredible.
Indeed. Then sort of racing through onto the next movie. So then we sort of jump forward to Rogue Nation. And I'll tell you, great to see Jeremy Renner back in again. Obviously, Rebecca Ferguson, incredible. I think the one thing that really kind of stood out for me in this movie, as in, I don't know whether it stood out for me in a good way, is Alec Baldwin as Alan Hunley, as sort of, by the end of the movie, full spoilers, he kind of basically takes on IMF. But There's something about Alec Baldwin where I can't separate Alec Baldwin from 30 Rock and the Alec Baldwin in any other TV series, because everything he says comes across kind of a little bit patronizing, kind of a little bit like tongue-in-cheek, kind of a little bit like slapstick. I don't know what it is, but he takes me out of the moment every time, so I'm never able to think of him as a serious guy.
Yeah, it's funny because I have the same thing with Alec Baldwin, but I actually have it with him from Glenn Ross and The Departed, those two characters, because he's so, and it's kind of a tribute to how strong he is when he is in these sort of movies in terms of his, what he leaves behind, because I know what you mean. I remember the dressing down that he gets from the chairman investigating the IMF in that movie was kind of a role reversal for him in this one. This is another one that ranks really, really highly for me. I think on reflection, I would say it's possibly not quite as good as The Ghost Protocol, but I really like the element of them, as you say, having to go rogue. They're off the grid, so to speak. And I think that gave it a bit of a different dynamic. Plus, of course, as you say, Jeremy Renner continuing on, and Rebecca Ferguson comes in, doesn't she?
She's so good. She's a great agent. And then I think, you know, if you're jumping forward into Mission Impossible Fallout before we sort of jump into the latest Mission Impossible film. So now we kind of sans Jeremy Renner. He's obviously busy being Hawkeye, but we do get Henry Cavill. And I think what is sort of most memorable, sort of most known for me in Mission Impossible Fallout is obviously we get some great scenes down in Wanaka, New Zealand, it's that great picturesque countryside. I love sort of the kind of alpha tension between Ethan Hunt and August Walker sort of throughout the whole movie. Obviously got Rebecca Ferguson back in. We're bringing back in Tom Cruise's wife. It just feels like it's really kind of like it's still a lot of big set pieces and a lot of big stunts and a lot of big action scenes, but I really enjoyed the story of Fallout. Like it was kind of, I don't know whether it was just because I watched so many in a row, but like I really enjoyed Ghost Protocol because it sort of felt like we shifted gear into like a more modern sort of storytelling. Whereas I think for me, Rogue Nation kind of felt like more of the same. Whereas then when you sort of jump into Fallout, I felt like we kind of like leveled up again, both in terms of cast, direction, set pieces. The stakes have kind of never been higher with, you know, IMF and who's in charge, who's behind the scenes. We've got, you know, Alec Baldwin back in again. Still had that same feeling, but a lot of great kind of characters and actors kind of pop up in here, which I just don't ever associate with the Mission Impossible franchise, like Wes Bentley from Yellowstone, as Eric in Mission Impossible Fallout. So, yeah, thoroughly enjoyed this one. I think this is probably up there with sort of one of my favorite ones of the ones reviewed to date. So had a really good time with it. Felt like the story moved fast. Henry Cavill is a bad guy. Always a fun time because I just think of him as such a wholesome, like he's Superman. He's The Witcher, like. But as a bad guy, it's a good time.
This is top of the lot for me and spoiler alert for Dead Reckoning, for even including that one so far. I know we've got one more to come. This is for me is top. That's my. I love this movie. I thought it had all of the elements. Christopher McQuarrie writing and directing, I think, you know, was a big advantage. I felt that the level between story and action was just spot on. It's one of those franchises where it's rare for the movies to be getting this good late into the franchise. You know, sometimes it's sort of like the longer they go on, they don't always. But I thought this was up there with 3, which we talked about last week as being another top one for me. I think the fact that they bring back in, as you said, Michelle Monaghan as Julia was really clever how they did that. I love Sean Harris as Solomon Lane. What an awesome, sinister voice. This is absolutely, like, if I was to say to someone, if you're only going to watch one, just come in and watch this one would be my number one.
Yeah, and I think this is where the Mission Impossible movies are kind of interesting, right? Because they kind of presume you've kind of carried on the lore of the Mission Impossible universe, and you might, like, you know, with people like Alec Baldwin, with people like Solomon Lane, like, and if they're not kind of fresh, or even with Rebecca Ferguson, like, if you don't kind of have the context of what's happened to those characters in the previous movies, it can be a little bit like, do I know what's going on here? Can I follow the story? But yeah, this one's great. This yeah, I think it's up there as a favourite at this point.
And special shout out to our old mate Jamie Dudden. Wes Bentley shows up in this one too, which was a bit of fun.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So yeah, so shall we jump into our joint watch this week? One of our joint watches, which is Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. So this movie came out last year. I know that you had already sort of done the rewatch of all the movies, so you were obviously looking forward to it. I wanted to sort of catch up now that this movie was available on streaming. What did you think of the latest IMF outing?
Firstly, it's interesting how they've decided to split that final movie and actually call it Part 1, and then, like, they could have easily have just called it whatever they wanted to call it, and then but obviously they're saying they're going for a Deathly Hallows type approach here. Obviously, there was a lot about this movie I really enjoyed, a lot, and the pace, again, the action scenes, the humor. I felt, you know, we were talking about Simon Pegg last week. I felt some of the banter between Tom Cruise, Simon Pegg, Ving Rhames in particular, thought that was back to core, you know, core Mission Impossible humor, which I think is an important factor for it. Where it falls down for me a little bit, and this is, I think, a personality thing as much as anything else, is I can't quite deal with an enemy being, sorry, we are talking full spoilers, just for anyone who hasn't seen this movie, please use the time codes, jump ahead to Masters of the Air. I can't deal with the baddie, the big bad, being an artificial intelligence. I can't, I don't know if this is a limited mindset on my part, but I need something tangible, a bit more like the fact, you know, no matter what you try to do, Ethan, the computer has thought of every move, and it becomes a bit of, too all-encompassing, and just the fear factor wasn't as real for me, even though we had what's the show, my goodness, Ozark, as the handoff guy. The train scenes, all great scenes, but I just needed that Solomon Lane, I just needed that Philip Seymour Hoffman, I just needed that level of villain for me, and that was just where it just fell short. But I don't want to detract away from it, because we had absolutely a blinding time watching this movie, and it is a long movie at 2 hours 43, but it didn't feel like it.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with everything you've said. Like, it was a long movie, and I think having watched these movies in such quick succession, the movie format is pretty similar in every movie. It's kind of like, you know, introduction of big bad, something kind of goes wrong, mega chase scene of some type, whether it be on cars, motorbikes, planes, trains. That chase scene normally goes for a good sort of 30 to 40 minutes. There's some double crossing, and then we go back to next big action to kind of wrap it up. And I think that is probably the flaw with this one, is the big bad being AI with a combination of some sort of smaller time players. And so the whole premise of this movie is they're trying to find two pieces of a key, and nobody knows what this key does. And in a way, no one knows what the key does. There's two halves, destroy one half, and then no one can use the key for what no one knows about anyway. Like, I feel like there was some sort of like plot parts of the story that were a little bit paper thin, but at the same time, I think they're having such a good time filming another huge kind of blockbuster that it all kind of worked. But at the same time, it still feels like you can tell they're getting to the end, because, you know, they're a little bit more reckless with what characters kind of live and die through different moments of this film. And so obviously they're sort of starting to kill a few people off. You can kind of see everyone's getting a little bit older. But, yeah, look, I still had a good time. This movie does get pretty good reviews around the place. I don't know. I definitely wouldn't call it my favourite of the whole series to date. And it will be maybe interesting when we do get part two to sort of see how much is it a part two. And I actually think I would have almost rather they called it something else but carried on, even if they're carrying on the same storyline like you're saying. I think the part one, part two kind of, it throws off the, you know, the other seven movies that haven't done that, but because there's clearly some part twos to some of those other movies as well.
The great thing for you, having done this rewatch more recently, of course, is the shock factor, which of course I had too, but I loved Henry Kearney coming back as Kittredge. We haven't seen Kittredge since the first movie in 1996, and to bring him back in was just, I thought, a really great move. I love it when they sort of shock people with that. His introduction was really welcome in this movie. The other welcome introduction in this movie is Hayley Atwell as Grace. I thought she was really good. Her character did some annoying things, like, you know, she needed so much convincing to actually, you know, believe Ethan and to do, you know, to sort of to go with him and to not turn against him. And there was so much of that going on that was a little frustrating. But her, again, her screen presence and her comedy element and all the rest of it, I thought she was a really good, you know, coming in, you know, with her and Rebecca Ferguson, Vanessa Kirby, there was a lot of really strong actress talents in this movie, because this is often looked at as a bunch of guys, and the numbers are really balancing up. And I thought, as a balanced team, I thought they were absolutely fantastic.
I think that's a good shout. I think it's such a great cast, and both new and returning actors and actresses. I'll tell you one thing, Paul, that I'm surprised that you haven't brought up yet, and it put me off right at the start, is I didn't like the way they introed this film. Like, I felt like they played a few kind of like, it was almost like they were playing a trailer of some of the big milestone moments, both in the beginning and at the end. And then I felt like the music didn't hit like it normally hits on the other Mission Impossibles. Like, they tried to get a little bit like fancy with a little bit of it, and I was like, Paul's going to hate this. And I hated it too.
Yeah, that's a good show. What it is a throwback, because what watching this movie did to me, and I was going to mention it later, but I'll mention it now, is it always makes me want to go back and watch that original TV show from back in the 60s and, you know, the 80s remake as well. I absolutely loved, I've watched like a good season of those ones from the original, and they are obviously aged, but doesn't matter. They're just so effective. But what used to happen at the start of each episode was, when the credits hit, they would play through scenes that were going to come up in that episode. And I can't think of anything, frankly, worse than that. It's like when you're watching a TV show and then you go to watch the next episode and the title card comes up and the guy that you thought was dead in episode six is obviously alive in episode six. Like, don't spoil it for me right before I'm about to watch it. I don't get it. I don't like it. And you're right. The music, unlike what I was talking about before from Ghost Protocol, didn't hit the mark. 100%.
I think they got there, but it took a little while to sort of start. Yeah. And I kind of felt like I almost wanted to shut my eyes, because I'm like, I don't want to see all the big stunts and scenes, because I think the Mission Impossible movies, the less you know going in, the better, like in terms of the, like, you don't want to watch the trailers because they really show off a lot of those big stunts in there. So, overall good. Like, I'm definitely going to be there for part two. I think you've got to give it to Tom Cruise. Like, I think he's done, had like a fantastic run at this. It'll be interesting to see whether there's kind of a handing over of the reins. You know, is it to someone like Hayley Atwell? Is it going to be a kind of a bit of a reboot, a bit like a 007 type thing? Like, you know, because the next one's sort of, and by all indications, clearly going to be sort of the end of the Tom Cruise run.
It will be interesting to see how they wrap it up. I think they'll go for a clean end. I don't think there'll be a handover to, you know, like we used to talk about with the Indiana Jones movie, handing the hat to someone. I think it will be a clean franchise end, because this has been an unbelievable run for a movie, this franchise that started in 96, for us to be talking about it. By the time Dead Reckoning Part 2 comes out, I think we're looking at essentially 30 years, which just makes me feel old.
Indeed. So I guess my big question, Paul, is do we want to try and rank these movies? Like, I don't even know if I can do it, to be honest. But we could. You've already probably ranked them before, but have you got a fresh ranking now?
Yeah, it's easy for me in terms of where it goes from the bottom, and that's number two.
Agreed.
As you talked about, that's right there. I think after two, the quality hits in straight away, so it becomes much harder because even what I just said, Rogue Nation, which is probably my next one, Rogue Nation probably comes in there. Then I think I go Ghost Protocol. Then I go the first one, because even though it's perhaps a little less on the action, there's something about the first one which is just magic, especially with the mask and Jim Phelps and all of that stuff. Then I go seven, Dead Reckoning Part 1. Then I go three, Mission Impossible 3, and then number one, as I said, was Mission Impossible Fallout. That's me. What about you?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty much in alignment with that, because I think you've got to give one more credit than the kind of the score kind of gives it, because I think it's the start of the franchise. Like, it's going to have a special place regardless. So yeah, I think I'd largely agree with that, right? That nice. Ranking. Very good. So those are the Mission Impossible movies. You can you can currently stream them all on Neon here in New Zealand. But Paul, shall we jump into our official watch of the week, which is Masters of the Air?
Yes, as advertised. So during World War II, 5 miles above the ground and behind enemy lines, 10 men inside an aluminium bomber known as a Flying Fortress battle anti-aircraft fire and unrelenting flocks of German fighters. This is a 9-part miniseries, and it is our watch of the week. Dan.
It is indeed. Now, obviously, this is kind of brought to us by producers, creators of Band of Brothers in the Pacific. This has very much been, as soon as I heard about it, I was in regardless. Mm. I'm going to come out the gate and say Apple TV, always high quality. I think it doesn't quite hit the level of greatness that Band of Brothers does in terms of, I think, emotional connection to the characters. But I think what the show does a wonderful job of, with a few extra caveats, is I always think, when I think about Warball, I think, I definitely don't want to be on a Navy ship. I don't want to be trapped at sea. That feels horrible.
Add that to our list of places we won't survive, right?
That's right. I don't know whether I'd go very well, like, as a soldier on the front line. And so I've always thought probably the coolest thing would be a pilot, because it's like, you know, yeah, you kind of a bit more in control. But what this series has taught me, Paul, is I would 100% be dead on the first day by flak. I'm going to get hit straight away, whether you're the pilot, whether you're the gunner, whether you're just like loading ammunition. I think this series does a frightening and wonderful small W job of sort of really showing you what it meant to sort of, you know, operate one of these big bombers, the hazardous missions that these guys had to go on, how they made it back, how, you know, by the end of this, some of them went on to fight in other wars. Absolutely mind blowing. I think there's some gaps in the story for me. Like, I think coming into this, I really avoided a whole bunch of trailers. I kind of was expecting a more rounded kind of, obviously, sort of, you know, it's based out of London. They were flying it. I expected almost kind of more RAF kind of involvement, and I wanted it to seem like more Spitfires and more kind of like fighter dog fighting type mechanic, as opposed to sort of these big missions and these big huge planes, which were both fascinating and different. And I think overall I had a good time, and I often sort of at the end of an episode would almost like, you know, kind of need to take a breath, because it was so harrowing, these missions that people had gone on. But it just didn't hit for me the same way that Band of Brothers did, and I can't help but feel like That's probably actually could be a great series because there's so many different avenues that you could cover. This is purely just a very small part of the American campaign, let alone the RAF, Australia, New Zealand, all the other sort of countries that got involved in it. Could have been very interesting as well.
Interesting, Dan, because I think I hear what you're saying, and I'm going to present a similar view, but a counter view as well. Same as you, if the trailer didn't already pull me in, hearing that it was made by the producers of Band of Brothers surely did. But anything around World War II in particular, I can't quite put my finger on why it fascinates me as much as it does. But I would preface my thoughts by saying, as soon as I heard, oh yeah, it's the producers of Band of Brothers, I just immediately disassociated my level of expectations, because for me, Band of Brothers is something particularly rare. And if, anyone goes and checks our website, Band of Brothers is a series that appears in my top 10 lists of all time. So to get into the final 10 of all time is pretty special. So that's where that sits. But without even drawing comparisons, I have to say Masters of the Air is still, as you say, a really extraordinary show. It really sits with me at the end of, every episode. I was, thinking about it. And by the end of the series, it did that wonderful thing where it put into context all the things that I had been stressing about this week, and that there have been some things, and it made me think, actually, we don't know how lucky we are. It really hit the mark, and it made me think of, what happened a lot. And there's not many shows that make me think for a long time after the credits roll these days. That's just the way things are. And to your point as well, I agree in terms of it not hitting as hard, but I think part of it in terms of the emotional connection, I think there's two reasons, and I could be way off, but for me, the Band of Brothers always started with Fade from Black, show us the survivors who the show was based on, and have them tell us in their own words what happened, and then go into the show and the dramatization of that. I shouldn't say dramatization, that's not what I mean. You know what I mean. And then at the end, they come back and we hear from them again. That really connects you every episode. That's really strong. The other thing, and I'm not sure how I quite piece this together, but with Band of Brothers, with the way in which that Band of Brothers were moving, they were going from place to place to place, and they were progressing, or they were getting hit back, but they were always on a mission to go somewhere new. Whereas there was, and this is not to diminish what each and every person obviously did, but there was something about, it was always get in the aircraft, take off, go do the mission, and we always come back to base. Get off, go to this mission, and we always come back to base. And there's something about the Band of Brothers story where each time they got to where they were going, you didn't know what that environment looked like because they hadn't been there before and they were getting to somewhere new. Whereas at the end of every mission of Masters of the Air, they were coming back to base. And I don't know how to express that any more clearly, because there was just something that I'm not saying it became repetitive, but it didn't have the unknown factor as much as Band of Brothers. And I think that's what made that a little bit more, careful with my words again, dramatic and compelling.
I think you're spot on, and I think I guess also relevant because Band of Brothers 2001, so a few of these people were still alive, like we're now getting on obviously a little bit longer again. So I think that fading from the real life person going through this to the actor playing the role really always kind of hit quite differently emotionally. And I think this is what was sort of hard about the show, is it wasn't until kind of episode 5, 6, 7 where I was starting to get familiar with the characters, because a lot of the time when they're up in the plane, they've all got masks on. And so apart from our sort of core pilots, when someone got hurt or killed, I didn't have the connection with who that was sometimes. And in the unless they were one of the main characters. So I think we're probably really nitpicking, because this is a truly fascinating and great series. I think you've got to give it up for Austin Butler and Callum Turner as Bucky and Buck. Like, I think they did such an awesome job leading this the effects, the props, the like everything about this, like you generally, like most of the time, kind of felt like this was such high quality CGI, and I think they filmed a lot of it in kind of you know, green screen sets with sort of like planes that kind of like rotated and stuff, and so they could sort of make multiple kind of actors have the same experience all at once, and I think it really shows. I think what I also enjoyed about this, and this was a pretty small component of the show, but I just loved sort of the fact they brought it in. I kind of wish there was more of it, but when they brought in the Red Tails, who flew the P-51 Mustangs, and how much of a game changer they were in the war and how they protected the bombers in the Flying Fortresses, and, you know, particularly just the group of pilots that flew those planes and how sort of famous they were. It just kind of brought a whole nother element to the show. And I think, again, just going back to the Band of Brothers link, what was kind of with Band of Brothers, it felt like we were moving through big stages of the war. And this, when we were moving forward, I think you're right, because when we come back to base, the fact that kind of we'd jump forward 6 months, 9 months, whatever it was, it didn't have the same kind of like mental meaning, because we haven't just lived through like a, you know, a whole episode and like the bitter freezing cold, or, you know, the hot summer of Germany or whatever it may be. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of good stuff. You're right as well. Like, it could never live up to the standards of Band of Brothers, because that is literally one of the best TV shows, in my view, ever made.
Yeah, and it really is that sort of level of quality. The performance levels that they gave, you're right to, you know, not just, I think, calling out Austin Butler and Callum Turner as Buck and Bucky. You know, if it wasn't that it was for real, you'd have to say, what are the chances? I mean, just incredible. Those two were exceptional. I would also call out Anthony Boyle, who I think we saw in Tetris. And you may well know him from a couple of episodes of Derry Girls and an episode of Game of Thrones, but he was really, really impressive as Harry Crosby. And then the other notable for me was Barry Keoghan. Not sure if that's how you pronounce this Irish actor's name, but again, we've enjoyed him in Banshees of Inisherin. He had quite a notable role in that movie, and of course, you know, in The Joker. Spoilers. I was going to say in The Batman, he also had a part. I was going to say I won't tell you what cameo that was, but I've just gone and given it away. Classic half measures there. Really good performances from all of those. I thought the scenes where, you know, some of them were taken in as prisoner of war and going in that direction, and of course not knowing, because of the technology at the time, not knowing what happened to those people, the pressure that navigators were under. It was down to the navigator to manually, with pencil and ruler and compass and all the rest of it, work out exactly where they were, and the precision by which they could drop bombs from such heights. Just, I think I'm fascinated by the technology, the level of technology for the time. Because when you think about, you know, when we watch movies like, the names escape me down, the World War One movie we watched not so long ago, and just that jump in tech was really, really incredible what they managed to achieve in such a relatively small period of time. The tech on board, like, you know, the gunner seats and all the rest of it. You can see how people talk about, just to make everything in the world about Star Wars, how George Lucas's inspiration for so many things was taken from things like this. Just a really strong emotional story all throughout, particularly come the end, obviously.
I think too, what really kind of sat with me through this is what you said around, it really puts in perspective like what a bad day genuinely actually looks like, and the stuff that we face today is nothing compared to this. Yeah. And it also really just got me thinking now, like, you know, it's not even 100 years since World War II. And when you think about like the technology movements, and you think about just how much has changed and not changed all at the same time, it's kind of incredible to kind of sit back and reflect on. And that, like, what is a 100-year, I don't know whether the word is, like, it's not celebration, it's probably memorial of World War II is going to look like. And, you know, in the next sort of 15 years.
Joe, I live in a I wouldn't call it rural, but certainly a very smaller regional area, and we have a voluntary fire station, and when they call the volunteers in, they start up the, you know, it's essentially
the air raid.
And it's like, it's, obviously I didn't live through these times, but even hearing it freaks me out. And when you hear it in Masters of the Air, it's just terrifying. But the look, and obviously CGI of those planes coming across the sky, just imagine looking up and seeing that. I mean, just it's unfathomable, and it's the sort of show that I need every couple of years, at a show like this or a rewatch of Band of Brothers, to bring me back into that level of perspective.
Just, and I think some of those scenes where, like, there's just like the sky is filled with planes, or like as planes start getting shot down, and just some of the harrowing conditions of, you know, making sure all of your crew gets out, the vulnerable position that you're in if you're sort of a gunner versus if you're a pilot versus if you're in charge of the bombs, even jumping out of the plane is hazardous, let alone where you're going to land, what territory you're going to be in. And I think that they kind of touched on some of the things, particularly as, you know, people crashed and some survived, some didn't, that kind of happened in some of that wider Band of Brothers story. And it's like, it's, I think you're right, like, this is a great to kind of almost capture the history in a way, and it is always fascinating, like a bit like Band of Brothers, but not done to the same level, to see who kind of lived. And it was both, like when the credits kind of rolled on that final episode, it was, I kind of just felt this like emotional kind of emptiness, because it, particularly when it said some of these poor pilots went on to the Korean War, the Vietnam War, like that, they just, like, this wasn't their last tour, and just to sort of had to go back and live through that multiple times and survive is just that's some incredible luck and skill.
Correct. And so many of them went on to teach as well, I noticed as well, really. Yeah. And lived, you know, what I would say is very good, to a good age. You know, a lot of these people were well into their 90s. There was the dude who was 100. The very first couple of missions, obviously as it goes on, they speed up the takeoff, but the first couple of missions, they really play into the amount of effort it takes to get one of these planes off of the ground and to get them ready for takeoff. And you become very, you know, by the end of the 9 episodes, you've sort of become very familiar with the setup of these planes and where each person is located and how you get from one place to another. They do a really good job of getting you to understand and to a certain extent appreciate what it is like to be on board one of these things. I felt they really, because so much of the series is set, obviously, in the plane, so they do that well.
I think where I would fail, my first hurdle, Paul, would be, how am I getting into that plane? Because you know how they just like open the hatch and then they just use swing their upper body strength to like swing in. I'd be the laughing stock, because I'd be like, people having to like, you know, like push me up. I'm like, can we lift up? You know, I need someone to pull me up. It would be a real disaster.
To see you, I can see you just walking away, shaking your head. Your glasses are smashed.
Yeah, that's right.
No good to anyone.
I actually remember making a lot of these like planes as models when I was a kid, and I remember always being fascinated by all the different, like, you know, the front gunner and the bottom gunner, tail gunner, and just sort of like, you know, painting them up like this. So there was definitely a real sort of nostalgic feel to it as well. So yeah, look, overall had a great time. It is unfair to compare it to Band of Brothers, because it's not Band of Brothers, but it's, yeah, it was great. I would watch more of it. I know that there's not going to be more. This is a limited series for a reason. And I know you can't delve every single story under the sun, because you've got 9 episodes. But I had a good time.
Yeah, 100%. 100% recommended. And as Dan said, that's available on Apple TV Plus. Next week, watch of the week will be The Walking Dead, The Ones Who Live, or as you prefer to call it, Dan,
Ricky and Mickey.
Ricky and Mickey, available to watch in New Zealand on TVNZ Plus. And as always, to see a schedule ahead of our watch of the week, just click the link in the show notes to see what we've got in Discord, and you can see what's coming up over the next 3 weeks.
Very good. So we'll be coming in hot on that one, because I think the final episode drops on Monday night, if I'm correct, Paul.
Correct. So we will be coming in hot, as you say. We'll be ready and fresh in our mind, ready to talk once again The Walking Dead.
Indeed, indeed. Paul, what is your pick of the week?
utopia. As we just talked about, loved Masters of the Air, but Utopia has come at a right time for me, where it's become my watch on the train to and from work when I really need those that little bit of a lift, and it's gold. As I say, if you love The Office, Utopia. What about you?
I think for me, I'm going to have to go with Masters of the Air, just because of it was so different. It's been a long time since we've had a great World War II show, that, you know, for all the reasons we just talked about, it was so well produced, great cast, fascinating, educational, gives you a different respect for things going on in the world. But yeah, Masters of the Year for me on Apple TV. Paul, shall I take us over to the news desk?
Let's go.
All right, so a couple of things. So Tim Chalamet has signed a first look deal with Warner Brothers following the success of Dune Part 2 and Wonka. So I don't know about you, but I would love the idea of someone giving me a first look deal. So in basic terms, this is coming from IGN. What they described it, so in basic terms, it gives the studio the right of first refusal to a collaborator's projects, or to simply put dibs in. So in short, it's basically a sign that we'll be seeing more of Timothée Chalamet, and it's that right of sort of first look includes not only starring him but also being a producer as well. So obviously Warner Brothers investing heavily. That seems great. A first look deal. It just seems like what a great notion. So congratulations to him and no doubt Warner Brothers. Other news, what have we got here? So Bad Boys 4, I'll be there for it, officially subtitled Ride or Die, and there is a new trailer, and it will be hitting theatres on the 7th of June, so not too far away. Big fan of the Bad Boys movies. Not sure how it's going to go with just given all of the various Will Smith controversies, but you know what? Ride or Die, I'll check it out. We've also got, speaking of trailers, we've got a Beetlejuice trailer, which has just dropped. It's more of a teaser than a trailer, but I don't know if you've watched this one, Paul, but so great to see Michael Keaton back as Beetlejuice. And I love the line, the juice is loose. That's,
yeah,
it's gold. We've also got a new trailer that's dropped for Matt Reeves' upcoming The Penguin TV show, which is part of the wider kind of Batman universe. Then we've got another bit of news. It looks like there's going to be a reboot officially of the Pirates of the Caribbean series. So the sixth movie will be a fresh start, which will be interesting to see what they do with that one. And then two final bits for me. So Euphoria Season 3 has been delayed, but apparently not actually cancelled, even though the cast and crew of Euphoria have been told they are free to pursue other activities, which is interesting because a lot of that cast and crew is already well into their 20s, if not early 30s, and they're playing teenagers. So interesting to see where that's going to go. And then final bit of news for me, Paul, is it looks like Happy Gilmore 2 is in the works. I loved Happy Gilmore as a kid. I thought it was one of the funniest movies I'd seen. I don't know if that will translate into today, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure we need a number 2, but if it's coming to Netflix, I'll definitely, you know, I'll check it out. But interesting times ahead. I imagine they're going to get a lot of the old cast and crew back together. But that is me, Paul. Anything on your side?
I'm still processing Happy Gilmore too. I just see all the memes, all the GIFs coming right at me. Tap, tap, tap it in. Well, what are you waiting for? All the rest of it. Only a couple more things from me. We've got a new Bosch spin-off series confirmed, which is interesting because it's the first Bosch series that's going to not have Titus Welliver as Harry Bosch lead the line. Got a new series coming with Maggie Q to be the lead. So we love that universe. So definitely going to be there for that. And kind of news, because we're geeks and we like it. The Transformers Skybands comic, they've reinvented the franchise by going back to like a real G1 1980s look. It hasn't been done quite like this in some time. There's a whole bunch of images online. Just exciting to see the Transformers that we love and we know from back in the day returning in that form. So yeah, that's the only news stories that caught my eye, Dan. Mailbag, after officially having the busiest one last week, what have I got this week for you, Dan? Absolutely nothing. So nothing in our mailbag this week, with the exception, of course, of those contributors to our peak performance suggestion, which, of course, was Simon Pegg, of which you've watched a number of his movies again this week, Dan. These are our peak performance picks. Richard went with Big Train. This is an old school shout, and I even thought of it when I was looking at him last week, and I thought, there's no way anyone's going to think of this one, because it's like an old, I don't know if it's 80s or 90s. I remember watching it sort of as a teenager, so maybe it's around that time. It's like a sketch show, really funny. Great call from Richard. Diana went with Shaun of the Dead. Samara was completely aligned to me. Went with both Benji in Mission Impossible and Scotty in Star Trek, both equal. So no honorable mention or peak performance, just two equals there. And Paddy, a 3-2-1 of Doctor Who, where he did star. It was just the singular story, but you know, every performance counts. So yeah, he went with the story of The Long Game. And runner up, Shaun of the Dead, peak performance, Hot Fuzz. That's the mailbag, Dan.
Very good. Shall we jump into our peak performance for this week?
Indeed. So each week, Dan and I take turns to choose someone from the movie and TV industry, look back at their work and try and pick out what we think is their best work. And this week, Dan, the peak performance is for Eddie Murphy.
Indeed. So I'm surprised we haven't done Eddie Murphy. He's such a classic, classic actor. I think I'm actually, as we're saying this, I'm wondering whether I'm actually going to change my mind mid discussion. What are your thoughts on adding a stand-up comedy to a peak performance? Is that approved or not approved?
I'm trying to think if we've ever done it before. I think we are.
It's a performance.
People's work. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's okay, it's a performance. So I think I'll allow it.
I love this. I'm glad. And I literally just thought about it about 3 seconds ago. So I'm coming in really hot. So I'm going to start then with my honourable mention of 1984's Beverly Hills Cop. I think, you know, obviously you and I are both excited for the new Beverly Hills Cop series, movie to come out. I think this is great soundtrack, great cast, great classic like 80s storytelling. I think Eddie Murphy as Axel Foley, just such a fantastic role. He's such a fun, I don't know, so it's just, everything I think about it is just pure 80s, and I just can't go past it as a top cop show. So that would be my honourable mention. But for my peak performance, I'm going to go with Eddie Murphy's 1983 stand-up show Delirious, which was one of those, like, honestly, just laugh-out-loud, funniest stand-up comic shows I've ever watched. I remember I've listened to, like, audio versions of it when it sort of first came out, then eventually sort of seen the live stand-up. Just it was so groundbreaking, like, for me as a at the time. Like, I think when it came out, like, I would have been, what, about 14, 15? So I probably didn't even see it for another, you know, sort of 3 or 4 years after that. And it was just so edgy and racy. Like, it's probably pretty tame in today's time, but top tier comedian, top tier comedy. So Beverly Hills Cop and Delirious for me. How about you, Paul?
Awesome. Well worth including that. Great shout. My honourable mention, Dan, is a voiceover role, which I'm trying to think, have I ever had a voiceover before? But this is as the voice of Donkey in Shrek. For me, yeah, possibly one of the greatest all-time voiceovers, certainly in an animated comedy movie for me. I just, like, head and shoulders, with all due respect, above the rest, just like the funniest character on the screen. Hilarious to the point where voice acting truly shows how worthy of all the accolades it gets, you know, as being, as an on-screen performance should be, just an absolutely brilliant performance across all of the Shrek movies, and the cameo appearance in Puss in Boots, just really, really good. So Donkey is my honorable mention, but yeah, peak performance, no surprises, is that original 1984 Beverly Hills Cop. I think the character of Axel Foley, even in the third movie, which was awful, still transcends that and is still funny. But that first movie in particular was just absolutely incredible. This was one I've watched an unbelievable number of times, and I think the reason for it was one of them that I had on a VHS tape as a teenager. Mm. And so, of course, back in those days, whatever you had on video got watched a lot. So, you know, add that to the Superman 2, Batman 1989 and Star Trek 5 list. It just got watched a lot. He perfectly nailed the character. The relationships with Taggart and Rosewood and everything was just so good. And yeah, as a package, with, as you said, the music, the 80s-ness of it, is wonderful. So yeah, I'm gonna go with Donkey and Axel Foley, Beverly Hills Cop.
That's such a good shout out. I didn't even think about the Shrek movies, but that's such a good call. So I love it. Well, I guess that brings us to the end of another episode of the Half Measures podcast.
It does indeed. Thank you as always for listening in. And if you've got any comments on it, Masters of the Air, Mission Impossible, or anything we've talked about, do get in touch at halfmeasurespodcast.com or on our social media.
Also, a very special shout out to our Patreon producers, Samara Whiting-King, Diana Kanawa, Trisha Brady, Tony Baby Horsefall, and Michael Chalmers. If you too would like to become a Patreon producer, then you can find those details in the show notes below. But until next week, everyone, adios.